iFaith series on the Sermon on the Mount, the material found in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. Thank you for your interest. There's another iFaith series, perhaps you've completed it, going through the entire Bible with 120 mini-sermons. This is not the same. Those are numbered 1 to 120. In this series on the Sermon on the Mount, the lessons are lettered. So today is message A, then there'll be message B, and so forth. We're, of course, able to look at the heart of Jesus, even the heart of his teaching, and in many of the Gospels, it's quite clear. It's actually hard to miss, although we tend to latch on to various commands and things that seem to relate to us. But most of the material that Jesus emphasizes is about the heart. It's about the kind of people we are. Matthew is interesting because in this Gospel, Jesus is presented as a second Moses. Now, I discussed that, I believe, in the previous iFaith series. But let's just review that a bit. Moses, of course, goes up on the mountain. The Lord speaks to him, Mount Sinai, and gives him the Ten Commandments. And there's more, but that's the heart of it. It's a compendium, you could say. Let's come back to that word in just a moment. We read in Matthew 5, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountain and sat down. His followers came to him, and he began to teach them. And so, if I'm correct, the Sermon on the Mount is a collection of Jesus' teaching, the most important teaching, that he relayed to his followers. And another reason many scholars believe Jesus is portrayed as the second Moses is that the books of Moses, so-called Genesis through Deuteronomy, those five books, are paralleled in the Psalms, because if you read the Psalms of David and others, the Psalms are in five books. Jesus' teaching material, I don't mean the miracle stories and other things, narrative, but his teaching material in Matthew is also in five sections. The first of them is chapters 5 to 7, which is about our character. We have chapter 10 where he commissions the followers to go out, chapter 13 on the kingdom, chapter 18, things that keep us from the kingdom, and then there's one more teaching block, chapters 24, 25 on judgment. So it seems quite deliberate. And one more thing on this idea of Jesus being the second Moses. Moses himself said in Deuteronomy 18, or actually the Lord said, there would be another prophet like Moses who would come. Now, Moses did miracles. He gave the teaching. He led the people. He was humble. There are a lot of things about Moses. But there's no one else in the Old Testament, no man, no woman, fulfills that prophecy, those details of Deuteronomy 18. But when we come to the New Testament, we find Christians using Deuteronomy 18 as a proof that Jesus is the one Moses spoke about, sometimes called the prophet. And that is what's going on here. So read Deuteronomy 18 later on if that's unfamiliar to you. So Jesus is the second Moses. So he's not just our leader who does miracles. He's the one whose word we need to follow. And that's why we're focusing on Matthew 5, 6, 7. This is a compendium. I used to think a compendium was a very long technical book. That's not what a compendium is. It's the opposite. Compendium is something that's short. Now, give you an example. Believe it or not, this 700-page book is a compendium because it's a compendium of 10 or 20,000 pages of material. The fact that the writer was able to take the essence and put it in just under 700 pages, that's great. Now, that may frighten you. Here's another example. This is a tour book, a little guidebook, Malta, that little island in the Mediterranean. In a few weeks, I'll be there with friends. I'm leading a tour in Malta and Sicily and Italy. This is on Paul's prison journey. Basically, it's Acts 28. Well, Malta is a country, but look how thin the book is. So it's not telling us everything about the history of the Maltese or all of their food or all the buildings on the islands, but it's actually put into, in this case, about 100 pages, you know, about the currency and the weather. And, you know, this is handy. I like that. I mean, I could put that in my pocket and read it or reread it. Very good. Now, please don't think for one moment that I'm suggesting we should ignore the rest of Matthew. That is, only read Matthew 5, 6, 7. I think the other 25 chapters are also inspired and important, and so are the other Gospels. But in the early church, we know this because there are thousands of pages of written that have survived in the early centuries. Matthew was the favored Gospel. And in Matthew, especially the Sermon on the Mount was frequently quoted. I hope that makes sense. So what is in the Sermon on the Mount? Well, let me go through. I've made a list of topics here. The blessings, the Beatitudes, we'll come to that in a moment. It's really about our character. Being salt, being light, how Jesus fulfills the law. About anger, murder, adultery, divorce, oaths, fasting, loving your enemies, judging others, true prophets, false prophets, true disciples, false disciples, wise builders, foolish builders, the golden rule, treasure in heaven, and so forth. Now, chapter 5 is really about who we are inside. That's the first half, where we'll begin in the next lesson. And then the second half is on how we view others and how we treat them. Chapter 6 is on the kind of religion that God accepts. In our heart, we have to have the right motives, and we trust Him. Chapter 7 is about God's generosity and our generosity and seeking His will and being respectful of others and warning against those who will try to change God's will, building on His word. Now, those are all incredibly important, but notice the kinds of things that are left out. I'm asking this because many Christians, if you ask them, what are the key teachings? What should we focus on? They would probably give a list of activities. Well, you need to put in a certain number of minutes a day in prayer and Bible study. And there needs to be an evangelism plan. And you need to come to church more than once a week. You need to come on Sunday and Wednesday. Maybe in your country, it's Saturday or Friday. I'm aware that you are a very international audience. But we would tend to put things in about showing up to meetings, about giving money, supporting programs, agreeing with the fine points of theology. None of that is in the Sermon on the Mount. In fact, Jesus really pays fairly little attention to doctrine. Now, doctrine just means teaching. He was teaching all the time. So obviously, I'm wrong if we mean doctrine that way. But if doctrine means technical theology, you have to look at this teaching in this light and understand this, and if you don't, you're wrong, and you're leading other people the wrong way. That kind of emphasis, you really don't find. It's much more on the heart. And so this is interesting, and I do have a question I want to leave with you before I go to think about until next time, but just hang on. Let's talk about the Beatitudes. We're basically preparing for the next I Faith message. There are 8 Beatitudes here in Sermon on the Mount. There are actually dozens of Beatitudes in the New Testament. You'll find some in Luke. You'll find a number in the book of Revelation. But we're focusing on these. And before I read through the Beatitudes, keep in mind that it says blessed, but blessed or blessed could be worded fortunate. Some versions say happy, though I think that sounds a bit too light. Blessed or fortunate. And all of these Beatitudes are surprising, would have been surprising, especially in the world 2,000 years ago. But most of them are surprising even today. Let me read the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. And blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Actually, that last beatitude is a double beatitude. We'll read the whole thing when we get there. This is a part of the Bible that, as a young Christian, I tended to read through very quickly. Like, I thought, well, if hungering and thirsting for righteousness means I want to live a radical life, then I'm all in, and I need to be pure and pure in heart. And I am being persecuted. I actually did receive a lot of opposition as a young Christian. Some of it because I was not polite. I would focus on some, but these are all essential. Our modern religious world, the world of church, that is, will look at this list, and more they say, well, that's a good way for women to live. But you cannot expect men, to be so holy or so meek, so weak. Men need to be strong and have angry conviction and take a stand. But actually, this is for all of us. This is not a feminine passage. Similarly, the passage on the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5 is not for women. It is. But men too need to have love and joy and peace and the other things. So this is for all of us. And if you're thinking, well, I need to do a different kind of Bible study, maybe something on warfare or power or I don't know. Don't skip this. This is how Jesus leads off in the compendium of his teaching. This is something that's doubly highlighted by the Word of God. Now, that question for you, if someone lived by the Sermon on the Mount, but didn't know, was unfamiliar with the rest of the Gospels, could that person be a real Christian? If all he knew was Matthew 5-7, maybe didn't even know Matthew 28 about the Great Commission, evangelism, didn't even know Matthew 25, where Jesus speaks of the poor and so forth. But if someone lived this way, could she or he be saved? Now, I don't think you're going to say, no, it's not enough. But I've asked that question to enough people to realize it can make us anxious. You'll say, well, what about the other things? What about the church? I mean, the church is not even mentioned in this passage. So what does that mean for our teaching? What does it mean for us as Christians? What does it mean for the church today? I might also add this question. Are we sure that we have understood the heart of Christ's message? Or have we done what many do and focus on externals, rules or guidelines, instead of looking at Jesus and seeing the very heart of God? Well, in the next few talks in this series, we'll go through the Beatitudes. Next time, we'll be looking at the first two, poor in spirit and those who mourn. So think about these things. Think about what God really wants. He's not just looking for behavior, for conformity to the rules of a group, but he's looking for us to obey his Son and to become the kind of men and women that Jesus spoke about in such wonderful texts.